Word of mouth.
From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
First, you get the buckets ready, clean the pans, and gather firewood late in the winter. It's maple syrup time.
After years of record high temperatures, sugar houses across New England are waiting out this winter's deep freeze and crossing their fingers that it will make for plenty of sap. Sugaring is one of the nation's oldest agricultural crafts and is now a multi-billion-dollar business, shadowed by cutthroat competition, sap heists, charges of tree doping to increase yield, and a federation that influences the international market. That's what operations like Bascom Farms in Acworth, New Hampshire are up against. Bascom is one of the largest producers of pure maple syrup in New England, making up to 80,000 gallons of sap a day, a mind-boggling number that got the attention of the writer Douglas Wynot. He decided to follow the Bascom family to get a better understanding of the maple syrup industry, and his new book is called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. Douglas Wynot, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So I learned a lot in this book, plenty, one of which was that the maple syrup industry peaked around the time of the Civil War. Now, why was that?
Well, at that time, a lot of people were making maple sugar. It was a dry sugar that they used as a staple. And also, there was a political movement in this country that was called No Sugar Made by Slaves. It was an abolitionist feeling, especially in Vermont, I've read. And going back in history, Thomas Jefferson spearheaded a movement of self-sufficiency in this country to produce maple sugar in order to compete against the sugar industry in the Caribbean. It was the peak of the maple sugar industry, and it went steadily down from the 1860s until the 1960s. When Bruce Bascom began to produce maple syrup and use plastic tubing instead of buckets.
Bascom's family made a transition from dairy farming into the maple business and has since grown this huge empire. Mm-hmm. Give us a little sense about how that evolved.
Well, when Bruce was a boy in the 50s and 60s, he worked alongside his dad, tapping trees, putting in spouts, hanging a bucket on the spout. The sap would go drip, 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 and they would empty a bucket every couple of days, a couple of gallons. And Ken Bascom decided that he would sell his dairy herd that his father had begun and that he had developed to 80 animals. And it was a big risk. It was a big leap for him to do that during that time. No one where he lived in that part of New Hampshire had ever gone into the endeavor of making maple syrup full-time. Well, this happened when Bruce was a teenager. He was about 13, 14 years old. And Bruce decided then that someday he would try to make a living making maple syrup. So he went to UNH. His father and his uncles had all gone to the ag school, but Bruce went to the business school. And for his senior project in an entrepreneurial marketing course, management course, he designed a project in which there would be 25,000 taps on plastic tubing all feeding into a central sugar house. And that was kind of a revolutionary idea. And at the time, people didn't believe that that would be possible. Bruce's classmates kind of made fun of him, called it the flubbing tubing product. He went to the bank the next year. The bankers refused to lend him money to do this. But his father talked to the bankers, and he went back, and he got the money for the tubing. And Bruce, along with Peter Rhodes and a cousin, eventually set up the largest tubing system in New England and became the largest producers of maple syrup in New England within about a decade. And Bruce is a real energetic go-getter type of guy. So he just started adding on and adding on and adding on. As a matter of fact, his first year back from college, he went around knocking on doors and asking if he could rent trees from his neighbors. He rented one tree, you know, many, many trees at 10 cents per tap and gathered, as a result, gathered so much syrup that he overwhelmed his dad. That was kind of the beginning of what became the biggest producer in New England and remains the biggest producer in New Hampshire, Bascom Maple Farms makes about one quarter of all the maple syrup in New Hampshire.
And how does it stack up in competition with the fake maple syrup, you know, the Mrs. Butterworths and Aunt Jemimas that we see in supermarkets and on tables all over the place?
Yeah, well, that's their problem. I mean, they're always up against the artificials. That is an $18 billion industry with syrups made from high fructose corn syrup and artificial caramel color and then a flavor derived from the fenugreek plant. I asked Bruce recently what the average consumption of maple syrup was in this country, and he said per person it's about 3 ounces.
Wow. I guess he wants to get that number up.
I guess he does.
Now, wait, you mentioned an $18 billion market. How much is the pure maple syrup market?
I heard it's $800
million. Oh, wow. So just a fraction.
Yeah. So it's under a billion, and you know, that was the number that Bruce gave me. So it's very small.
We're getting schooled in maple syrup with Douglas Wynot. He's got a new book out called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. For his research, he followed Bascom Farms in Acworth, New Hampshire, in their operations day in and day out for a couple of years to get a sense of the industry, which is a multi-million dollar industry, and it also has its kind of shadowy side. Last year, we reported on a maple syrup heist in a town just north of Montreal. 6 million pounds of maple syrup worth about $18 million wholesale, stolen from a warehouse. Doug, what does this reveal about the underbelly, the black market operating in the maple syrup industry?
Well, that was all based in Quebec, where there is a huge maple syrup industry. And most of the commercial producers, or all of the commercial producers in Quebec, are members of an organization called the Quebec Federation of Maple Syrup Producers. It has a French name. The federation controls the bulk sales of maple syrup. And they also, starting in 2002, started what they call the Global Strategic Reserve of Maple Syrup, most commonly called the surplus. And they began to set aside a certain amount of syrup to provide supply in case there was a shortage.
So like federal strategic oil reserves or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, wow. Like that. It's the same thing. So after they started the surplus, there were a few years where there were big crops and they had in their supply a whole year's worth of crop. And so as a result, the Federation established quotas and there were some serious conflicts as a result of that, and there were threats, and the president's sugar house was burned down. But it proved to be right, because between the years of 2006, 2007, 2008, there were some winters that were extended winters where it was very, very cold, and then it suddenly turned to spring, and the crops were way down. And as a result, there was a supply available from the Federation to sell to the supermarkets and to put on the shelves. So anyway, in 2011 into 2012, a group of people in Quebec went into one of the Federation warehouses and began emptying barrels. They filled some of the barrels with water and left some of them empty. On July 30th, 2012, an auditor went into this warehouse. It was a rented warehouse. The Federation was building a third warehouse for the supply, the surplus. And the auditor went in and discovered that there was water in one of the barrels and there were some empty barrels. So an investigation began, and eventually arrests were made. It was a lot of syrup, 6 million pounds, 8,000 barrels, $20 million worth, so a significant amount. And that syrup kind of gradually bled into the market before the discovery of the theft. So this syrup was just sort of circulating into the market before anyone knew about this. The arrests were made at the end of 2012, I think it was 20, 23 people were charged and arrested, and the trials still are
who was behind him? Were these just like hired guns or what?
Well, it was various people in Quebec who were opposed to the Federation and the control of the Federation, and who were trading in black market syrup, say, before the stolen syrup came onto the market. I mean, when I talked to the director of the Federation, I asked her, I said, is there a black market? And she said, well, that's human nature.
Well, you're getting to something that's so interesting that comes across in the book. You know, we have this kind of maple syrup seems like one of the most wholesome things that you can possibly imagine, you know, tapping a tree, running a line into your barn. And it's really such a different thing. Bruce Bascom is tearing his hair out or trying to keep his stride half the time, figuring out how to balance the supply that's down in his cellar with what he's putting out in the market. You spoke to several owners of sugar houses that are so worried about, you know, will they have enough? Will they have too much? And this is all dependent on nature.
It is.
In order for these operations to survive in the future, what kind of technologies are they going to have to embrace?
You may remember that in 2012, it got up into the 80s, and for 10 days, temperatures were above freezing. What I discovered and what sugar makers discovered was that during this warm year, when sap was coming out of the trees at times like jelly or cottage cheese was what David Marvin described to me and other sugar makers because it was so hot, they found that they could still gather sap by using vacuum systems. Long after the people using buckets and who are on what is called on gravity, long after they're finished, people on tubing with advanced vacuum systems can keep making syrup. And Bascom's has been able to do that. They were able to produce a decent crop in 2012 when other producers had, you know, a 10% or 20% crop. So,
Douglas Wynot's new book is called The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. He is also the author of A Unit of Water, A Unit of Time, Giant Bluefin, and he teaches writing at Boston's Emerson College and lives right here in Langdon, New Hampshire. After a break, we're going to find out if Douglas Wynot can discern between the various grades of maple syrup. Stay with us for a blind taste test. But before that, New Englanders know that it takes a lot of fresh sap to make syrup. Consider NHPR like a tap line running from a whole forest worth of trees. Just a little bit of the precious juice, just enough to pay for the listening that you do, coming from each individual listener. Add your bit to the big boil, and we'll keep pouring on the news and information that enriches your day. Here's how you can show your support. And please, do it before this metaphor gets any further tortured. Here's how you can help.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth on NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Douglas Wynot about his new book, The Sugar Season, A Year in the Life of Maple Syrup and One Family's Quest for the Sweetest Harvest. Well, after the interview, we asked Douglas to stick around for a sticky challenge, a blind maple syrup taste test. The aim was to test his ability to distinguish between the various grades of maple syrup. So we sat down with five cups. Three were filled with varieties of grade A, light, medium, and dark. There was also a cup with grade B syrup, which has a stronger maple flavor and has traditionally been used for cooking. And of course, the Ringer, a brand name artificial syrup. And because you can tell a lot by the color of syrup, both Douglas and I donned blindfolds for the occasion. Well, not blindfolds exactly. Our producers tied one of my scarves around Douglas's head, and I wore an Elmer Fudd hat over my eyes to prevent any accidental or intentional cheating. So I'm starting?
Yep. Yeah, you go first. Did you miss?
I hit the microphone. I'm thinking that's a grade A.
I'm thinking it's close to that. It's somewhere in the middle.
Maybe an amber.
Yeah, it doesn't have that strongish bite, but there's a lot of flavor. Maybe it's an amber.
You know, what are you looking for when you're tasting the syrup?
Sometimes it's the texture of the syrup, but I'm looking for that burst of the maple flavor that comes after it moves into your mouth, kind of spreads out over your tongue, and pops.
This smells much, much stronger.
Not distracted. Oh, it moves so slowly.
This feels like the flavor is out in front and the scent is out in front. You know, there's no subtlety there.
Right. Maybe I'll say that's the artificial. Well, when I was a kid, Vermont Made and those other syrups had 2% maple syrup. And it had come down from 15% originally, and then I think it went down to 8 or so, somewhere in that area, and then down to 2. And then one of the brands eliminated maple syrup and went totally artificial and gained in market share.
No kidding.
And that was devastating for the industry at that time. That was in the 60s.
All right, here you go. This is a really nice one. It's very It feels darker to me. It feels like it has a sort of heavier bottom.
Yes, it has a heavier bottom. That's a real strong maple flavor. To me, that's the best.
One of those back-of-mouth flavors, too.
And vanillin is one of the most dominant flavor precursor in maple syrup. And so I would say there's definitely a presence of the vanillin taste in that syrup.
Maybe it's grade B.
That's what I wrote,
that's
grade
what
B.
Thinking.
Some people used to say that grade B was for cooking, but I talked to a syrup producer who has an account in Cambridge at a restaurant, and he said that when the waitresses served grade B syrup, they got higher tips.
No kidding.
And he would bring lighter syrup to them. They would complain.
Oh, that's got a nice flavor. It's thinner.
There's something else in this.
I don't taste as much of the vanillin that you mentioned.
No, there's something else. It's so hard to come up with adjectives for the actual flavors, but this has something
warmer.
Warmer, orangey almost. Huh.
That's also delicious.
That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That moves differently, too, across your mouth.
It does. What is that? What is that quality? Is that just how much they boil it?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, they boil it to come to 66 or 67%. Maybe it moved a little bit beyond that, 68 or something. We're feeling that as it moves. But this is it feels lighter, but the flavor is sort of a, I don't know, centrality to the maple flavor. I'm going to try that again.
That was Douglas Wynot, professor of writing at Emerson College and author of a new book about the maple syrup industry and a family who makes it. After we tasted all five of the maple syrup varieties, we took off our blindfolds and checked to see how accurate we were. Of course, there was only one cup we really wanted to be able to tell from the rest.
All right, this is our moment of truth.
This is the...
Fake number two.
As long as we got the fake.
That's the important thing.
Here's to us.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you to Douglas for being such a good sport and agreeing to be filmed in a somewhat comical blind taste test. You can hear Douglas talk about his book at River Run Books in Portsmouth next Monday. That's March the 24th. There's more on the event, Douglas's new book, The Sugar Season, and a link to watch a video of our blind taste test. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org.
Maple syrup!
New Hampshire's Maple Weekend starts running this Saturday at sugar houses all over the state. They'll be open to the public with boiling sap and sweet syrup to sample. On Maple Weekend of last year, NHPR's Sean Hurley caught up with some producers who were still crossing their fingers after 2012's abysmal season and created this portrait of New Hampshire's maple syrup industry.
Paul Weeks would rather be in his sugar orchard checking sap lines for leaks or adjusting the boil on his evaporator. But today's bitter chill has given him an unwanted break.
Sitting here in the cold waiting for the sap to run. We're not going to get any sap till next week sometime for Lucky. It's supposed to be cold right through Monday, Tuesday.
Weeks waits for the sap in his sugar house in West Campton with his friend and fellow maple syrup maker, Bill Cheney.
What, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday? Right. Yeah, 5 days in a row of pretty good sap runs.
Yeah.
So it's starting out like a regular season, light syrup. Turning to medium.
Even though the weather has been promising, the ghost of last year presides.
You know, I think everybody this year is gun-shy after what happened last year when we had 70-degree weather in the middle of March.
Season ended about this time last year.
In Rumney, last year's heat wave still makes Maggie Brock shiver.
Last year was awful. It went for 8 or 9 days, and then we had that 5 days of 80 degrees, and that just killed it. Everybody else was loving the warm weather, and we were like,
yeah.
I was the only one that was depressed about the 80 degrees in March, you know. People were wondering, what's wrong with her?
Brox and her son Nate run a sugar house on Stinson Mountain.
And then this building always heaves. My dad said he built this whole thing, and I think every cut he made was with a chainsaw. I don't think he is. So it's, you know, it's kind of... Seen better days.
The stovepipe and tea-stained wood are deceptive. Like a DeLorean in an abandoned barn, the old crooked shack hides a gleamingly modern machine.
oh, a lot of it's science and a lot of it is intuition. It's both, you know. It's sometimes when you're running around up here, it's like you're running a submarine, constantly checking temperatures, pressures, switching valves, draining tanks, you know, trying to keep the whole thing running as smoothly as possible.
There's only one thing that happens throughout the entire syrup-making process. Water is removed. To that end, the introduction of the reverse osmosis machine in 1971, which mechanically separates pure water from sap, has been revolutionary. In his sugar house in Woodstock, Jim Fadden says the RO, as everyone calls it, makes him 4 times more productive than his father.
My father comes around and sees this when I'm doing it. He thinks I'm cheating because we're not working hard enough.
Like a lot of the syrup makers, Fadden is part scientist, part fortune teller. He reaches for a hydrometer as readily as an old wives' tale.
And I like a nice blue sky. Wind from the west, sap runs the best. Wind from the east, sap runs the least. Old proverb.
Does that have any...
Certainly does. You get an east or a north wind, and the trees will stop dripping. I have no idea why, but it's just one of those funny things. West wind, nice blue sky, low barometric pressure, sap runs to beat the band.
Fadden's great-great-grandfather founded the family sugar orchard in the early 1800s. His grandfather opened Fadden's General Store in 1896.
I don't know. I think maybe maple sugaring's like an addiction.
Or worse, as Paul Weeks and Bill Cheney describe it.
It's a disease.
What's the bad part of the disease?
You just want to keep expanding.
Yeah.
A little isn't enough. You got to keep going, keep going, keep going, get bigger, and yeah, that seems to be the way.
A little like fishing, a little like panning for gold. At $32 to $35 a gallon, and $1,800 or so a barrel, maple syrup is 13 times the price of crude oil. With that much at stake for Nate and Maggie Brox, maple season creates a kind of fever.
You're just waking up every morning, you're like, all right, what's the weather doing today? When do I have to be up there? Is it sunny here? What's the temperature at my house? If the temperature's 34 at my house, it's probably about 36 maybe up there if it's been in the sun. I'm like, you know, you get kind of anxious. And
you never know what's Mother Nature's going to throw at you. You know, you could have a great season. You could go to the middle of April, or you could be done next week. You know, you just... Yeah. Everyone says, well, how's... What do you think sugaring's going to be? And I say, I'll tell you May 1st. No clue.
It's a Rube Goldberg device. How the sun leans into the wind and warms the land, that squeezes the trees, that leak the sap, that trickles into the tanks, that bubbles and boils and thickens into a golden amber that you drizzle onto your pancakes one Sunday morning. It starts with the sun and the cold and ends with a smile or a sigh or just closed eyes. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
After the break, U.S. News and World Report just released its list of this year's best cars for family. We'll take a look at some of the makes and models and reasons why they made the cut with editor Jamie Page Deaton. Maybe you can imagine our surprise when we discovered that Jamie Page Deaton, the editor of U.S. News Cars, was living right here in New Hampshire. That's one of the amazing things that we've discovered about this state. There are so many people quietly living but doing really interesting jobs that involve a national, international, and local perspective. Word of mouth is all about finding these unexpected sources and unexpected stories. You know, that idea that sticks in your mind, the underpinnings of the way that our world works, and the innovative approaches that could make things work better. That's what we're hoping that you'll support today, cultivating ideas. Call now to support NHPR during our March fund drive. Here's how.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Between the perpetual nor'easters, the nights of sheer black ice, and the growing range of frost heaves, this has been the kind of winter that makes you put a lot of faith in your vehicle. even more so if you're regularly carting around a pack of kids. Jamie Page Deaton is managing editor at U.S. News Best Cars, which just released its list of the 2014 Best Cars for Families. And she joins us now to share it with all of us who are dreaming of a smoother springtime drive. Jamie, great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Are families looking for anything different now that they have before? You know, more safety, more space, what?
I think, you know, safety and space are the two big things families are looking for. Because first of all, space. As a parent, you can really preempt a lot of battles before they happen if everybody has enough room to get along. Nobody likes to be crowded, even little kids. And then safety, I mean, these are your kids, they're precious cargo. And you want to have as much safety, or families are looking for safety features that'll really help prevent accidents as well as help them survive it. And when we're talking about safety features, I'm not just talking about safety features for the big catastrophic accidents on the highway.
Right, the airbags.
I'm talking about safety features that are as simple as, you know, a backup camera to keep you from backing over a toy or, God forbid, a child in the driveway or at the parking lot at daycare. Things like that really make a huge difference and can make a family's life a lot easier.
Uh-huh. Is the era of the soccer mom minivan still kicking, or do families tend to go for SUVs nowadays?
Well, the minivan, not so much anymore. Most families are looking for SUVs, which, to be honest, you know, they're not the SUVs of yore. These are not truck-based vehicles. These are what we call crossovers, in that they have the space of an SUV, but they drive on car platforms, so they're a lot easier to drive, a lot more comfortable. And honestly, to me, they're basically restyled minivans, because inside they have the space and the features that minivans have, but, you know, you're in a little bit more of a stylish package.
Well, what kind of bells and whistles and style are new car companies scheming up now?
Oh my gosh, you name it, it's in new cars. You were talking about rear seat DVD entertainment systems, in-car Wi-Fi hotspots, so everybody can be, you know, on their tablet or their mobile device as you're driving along. You're talking about satellite TV in cars, so
wow,
kids won't have to miss an episode of SpongeBob or Dora. And then you're also talking about stuff to keep parents happy and connected. Systems that will read incoming text messages to you and allow you to respond by voice command. Similar systems which will allow you to update your Google Calendar from your car and get emails. So it's really, you know, it's about being connected not only to your kids, but also to the other things going on in your life while you're driving your kids around.
Well, so Jamie, you're a mother and another one on the way. Congratulations. Does that mean that you're rating these cars in a whole different way than you used to before?
Absolutely. Before I became a mom, I was always looking at performance first and foremost. Right after that was style. Now I'm sort of, whenever I'm rating a car, I'm always thinking, does this make my life easier? How hard is it to get the car seat in and out of this car? Can I lift my daughter in, or do I have to like bend down, and is it going to hurt my back if I do it 3 and 4 times a day? Is there enough space for everything we need to take with us? It has totally changed the way I look at cars. Now, the performance and the style are still important to me, but just adding in all these extra things to think about, and that's what families have to do.
Well, now I know that you, for your job, you test drive a lot of cars. You don't test drive with the kids in the car, do you?
Oh, absolutely. That's the way people use the car, so that's the way I'm going to test them. And honestly, you know, having my daughter and then the next one on the way has really added a whole new dimension to how I test the cars, because now I can understand why families would really want some of those features on a very visceral level. For example, you know, the Honda Odyssey, which is our best minivan for families this year, has a new in-car vacuum cleaner that's available. And at first I sort of thought, just don't let your kids eat in the car. That would be sort of the pre-parent me answer. But I actually had a test Odyssey a couple of weeks ago. We were on a road trip and my daughter got sick all over the back of the car. Now, if we were in our personal car, which is just a station wagon, we would have been in terrible trouble. But with the Odyssey, we flipped the third row seats down so there was a big area to go and change her without taking her outside in the cold. That vacuum cleaned the entire mess up. And all of a sudden I was like, oh my goodness, I know why people buy minivans. I understand it now.
Okay, the Honda Odyssey in first. What were some of the other honorable cars?
Some of the other honorable cars. And the thing with these awards is they cover 19 different automotive categories. So whatever stage of family life you're in, you know, whether you have a 2-year-old and a baby on the way like me, or if you've got teenagers and maybe grandparents moving in, there's a car that's going to work for you. Actually, Mazda, in a surprise, won the most awards. They won 4 different awards categories, with the Mazda 3 winning Best Compact Car for Families and Best Hatchback for Families. And again, this is sort of surprising thing for Mazda because they're known more for performance than family-friendly stuff. But because Mazda has started adding a lot of advanced safety features like forward collision warning, lane departure warning, and those types of things, which are actually sort of pushing cars towards a more autonomous driving experience, those are very helpful for families. And so that's what helped push them over the edge. Plus, I mean, honestly, once I drop the kids off at daycare, I want to have a little fun while I'm driving, and a Mazda's great for that. Other ones, if you're looking for something more upscale, the Cadillac CTS, which is our best luxury large car for families. This is a great one because parents can use it for date night and not feel like it's, you know, going for a date in a Honda Odyssey is not the most romantic thing, despite what Honda marketing would have you believe. But if you go in the CTS, you know, you've got a really nice upscale car, a lot of entertainment options, and the backseat's big enough for older kids if they need to spread out. Plus, it's also fun to drive. So it really is sort of a total package that keeps parents and kids happy.
When we spoke in your pre-mother self, you were looking for a car. What would you be looking for now? And we haven't really mentioned economy.
Economy. Well, but the one thing that these awards actually don't take into account is price, although most of these cars can be had, you know, with fewer features and you still get all the great safety and things like that. What we actually ended up doing, I was looking for a car, ended up not buying one until after my daughter came.
Uh-huh.
So, of course, that
changed. A lot more information.
We ended up getting a 2006 BMW 5 Series wagon, which is great because, and I always recommend station wagons for people if you don't have a whole lot of kids, you know, more than two kids. If you can get by with a wagon, get by with a wagon because they get better fuel economy and they're more fun to drive than a lot of SUVs. Now that we've been parents for 2 years, another one on the way, my husband's actually agitating for an SUV. He's sort of saying, oh, we don't have the space that we need inside the car. And he sort of has a point. I'm only 5'3", he's 6'1", which means that when there are car seats in the back, the front seats have to be moved up a little bit. So he gets a little bit more cramped than I do. But, you know, economy's important and you know, it's a lot cheaper to buy smaller car seats than it is to buy a bigger car. So that's probably the way we'll end up going.
Well, I have you here just very curious about how you car watchers and people in the automotive industry are reacting to this news about GM possibly concealing information about faulty ignition switches.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, it's certainly disappointing, I think, to think that a major car manufacturer could be putting people's lives at risk because there have been deaths associated with this possible malfunction. But then again, you've got to remember this is the industry that had, you know, the Ford Pinto, where the company was looking out for their bottom line first. You know, General Motors is a company that has shareholders that they have to answer to. And so profits need, from that perspective, I'm not saying it's the right perspective, but from that perspective, you know, profits need to come first. It's General Motors. It's not UNICEF. And I think, you know, we saw this, you know, like I mentioned with the Ford Pinto exploding, with the Toyota unintended accelerations, which, again, nothing with that could ever be fully pinned on Toyota knowing and hiding information, but it was still a major public relations problem for Toyota. And I think General Motors, who had been having a great comeback after being bailed out by the government, this is a really difficult time for them. This is a difficult story that they're going to have to handle. And it'll be interesting to see how their new CEO, you know, Mary Baer, the first female CEO of a major American car company, how she's going to handle it and how it ends up playing out.
Jamie Page Deaton, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Jamie Page Deaton, managing editor at U.S. News Best Cars, which just released its list of the 2014 Best Cars for Families. We have a list. You can check it out for yourself. And as she said, many different categories to choose from. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. When you're listening to Word of Mouth and all the programming on New Hampshire Public Radio, please remember that it is made possible by you, directly through your feedback, your ideas, and of course, your financial support. We've come to know that the most interesting stories do get passed around by word of mouth. It's your support for New Hampshire Public Radio that helps us continue to explore things that people are talking about in ways that add context and accuracy and understanding, and that connect you to your neighbors, your state, and your world. Here's how you can help.